The Tom Woods Show, episode 1945.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here. The Tom Woods Show.
Hey everybody, Tom Woods here. I am very glad to be back behind the microphone. I'm not quite 100%. I have been struggling with pneumonia. My gosh, does it take a long time to recover from this. Terrible, but the worst of the symptoms are behind me, and I'm really pleased to be back. And I'm so grateful for all the good wishes I received. I really did try to reply to every single one, and then I just decided I was too exhausted. I couldn't. But thank you, everybody, for your good wishes. My thanks also to the several people who filled in for me while I was gone. Stephen Kinsella interviewed people I've been wanting to interview for a while. My friend Larry Lepard, who's a great money guy. Shane Hazel. Then Dave Smith filled in. Scott Horton filled in. My thanks to all of them for doing that for me. Well, we are coming back today on the Tom Woods Show with a bang, because this is going to be a great conversation. I am joined today by two brothers, Fred and Richard Fairbrass, who back in 1989 formed the band Right Said Fred, and they have had tremendous success. They've had number one hits in 70 countries. Of course, they're best known for their smash hit song, I'm Too Sexy, and it turns out that they're great guys all around. They're not just, they're wonderful people, really, really not arrogant at all. Like, they have every right in the world to be arrogant, and they're not. Extremely friendly, wonderful people. But on top of that, they've been really, really sound on all the COVID craziness and the restrictions and what's been done to the arts and so on and so forth. And they are just perfect guests for this show, and I'm just delighted they've been able to join me. So let's jump right into to some questions for them. All right, gentlemen, obviously I want to talk about the UK and I want to talk about lockdowns and the arts and all this other stuff, but I can't help starting off asking you a little bit about your career, because it is so interesting, the smash you had. I know you've had other songs too, but that I'm Too Sexy song was such an unbelievable smash. I guess what I'm curious about is, what was the experience like where all of a sudden, everywhere you turn, everybody's going mad for this thing?
It wasn't exactly what we had
in mind. No.
We've always been independent. We've never signed to a major label. We like being independent. And that had been the case all through the 80s, although we'd done sessions for, I'd played for Bob Dylan and Richard did some stuff for David Bowie. We basically, as writers and stuff, wanted to be independent. So when we put Sexy out, which was on an independent label, we had no idea it was going to go so mental. And we had no real desire to be household names and that famous. It wasn't really in our diary, if you know what I mean. But you can't do anything about it. And you certainly can't dig your heels in and say we're not doing that, because opportunities like that are rare in pop music.
Yeah.
So we basically, I'm Too Sexy just shot off like a lunatic dog that we couldn't catch up with.
Yeah.
And we were chasing it for a few years.
We still are, really.
Well, yeah, sometimes we are, sometimes we're not. I mean, our writing has been successful, so we're really, really lucky to have had songs covered and songs.
And you're still licensing the rights to that all over the place,
right? Yes, we do.
Even now.
Yeah, we've actually just done a co-write, which is using part of I'm Too Sexy with, we're not allowed to say at the moment because it's not confirmed, but it's with the world's most successful rapper. And we're just waiting for him to send the final.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, it's for waiting for him to send the final mix. But we've been told to keep stum until it's official.
Yeah, sure.
But he's a big star. And so we're just very lucky. And other songs like Stand Up and You're My Mate, and particularly Deeply Dippy wasn't a particularly international hit, but it was huge in Europe and in the UK, and then went on to get lots of usage. And
also, you can't tell with it. We had a girl the other day who was, I don't know how old she was, who wanted a picture. When we're in Gibraltar.
Yeah, about
and
nine.
Her favorite, she was about nine, and her favorite song was Deeply Dippy.
Yeah.
So you can't, you know, you have these ideas in your head about who's going to like the song and what the song will do and who it will sort of reach out to. And it's never what you think. And I remember with Sexy, it took, from a personal point of view, I felt that it was about 4 or 5 years in before I really began to understand what that song was about. I had no real clue at the beginning. It was a bit like sort of just walking into a room that you'd never been into before. I didn't really understand them. any of it. Mm. And I couldn't understand why people liked it. To be absolutely honest with you, I couldn't, it was a mystery to me. Partly because when we wrote it with Rob, the three of us had never written anything like that before. We'd all come from different sort of backgrounds. And we were kind of expecting to be a sort of a regular band, you know, sort of, you know, kind of on the circuit, you know, the first single goes top 100, the next single goes top 50, the next single goes top 30. And it's a, and it's an incremental thing. And then Sexy just came out and blew that sort of, you know, that template completely out of water.
Yeah. I read just today you were the first UK band to reach the number one slot in the US with a debut single since the Beatles.
Yes.
So yeah. Highly unusual.
Yes, it was highly unusual.
Yeah, it was. It had legs of its own. It caught everybody by surprise. It just sold crazy amounts. Mm. I think it was number one for 3 weeks, but it was number one on the sales chart for 10 weeks because it back then used to mix radio and sales together. So radio dropped a little bit, but sales kept going. We did an interview with an Atlanta radio station about 10 years ago, and they had to playlist again because of the demand. It's a peculiar thing.
Yeah, it is.
You know, and to be honest with you, we're really proud of the track, and we've got loads of other songs we're very proud of and the sort of co-writes we've done. But Sexy seemingly has just become this thing.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, when we do it live, I really enjoy it.
Yeah, it's fun.
I know what it is now. And and also it cheers me up when we're doing it, and it cheers other people up the minute you start that opening line. But actually, going back to that very, very quickly, we were told right at the beginning with Sexy, when it was taken to record labels and all sorts of different people, you would never have a hit with a record that started with a vocal.
We were told
to forget it. If it starts with a vocal, it's dead in the water before you start.
Yeah. But I mean, these are the people who say groups with guitars are on their way out in 1963 or something.
Yeah, that's right.
Exactly.
You know, your story about not really wanting this kind of fame and notoriety, it puts me in mind of Rick Astley, you know, who wrote Never Gonna Give You Up.
Yep.
And after a short while, he just decided, this lifestyle's not for me.
That's right.
And he left the music industry entirely until very recently.
Yeah, that's right. He actually, we were talking to someone who worked with him, and I think he actually got out the car on the way to the airport. He was off to do some American promo, and I think he said, stop the car. And he actually just got out the car and walked.
I had tremendous admiration for that.
Yeah, and
I really do.
We had a similar conversation with Seal. He was he had a massive record when we would, I think it was Crazy or something. I can't remember what
Top
it was.
Top of Pops.
Yeah, there was a show in the UK called Top of Pops, which was the sort of the music show at the time. Yeah. And we were chatting with Seal, and he said, he was talking to his record company about promo. When the record company left, he said, no, fuck that. I'm not doing that. He said, I'm going to Thailand for 6 weeks. and I think we're not the only ones. I mean, in 1995, we started our own record label. We have worked with major labels because we've done licensing deals and we've done what they call label services. But we've never signed as an artist. We just don't like the control. We don't like the part being in the machine. And we're much poorer for it financially. But in terms of how we are as people, I think if we'd carried on that wheel that we were on, that cycle, then personally, I think I'd be dead by now. I would have indulged too much.
But we're also, we just like saying what we think. I mean, we were looking at the Isle of Wight Festival, you know, and it's just littered with bands who 6 months ago were saying they would never have the jab, and now they're all having the jab because they want to go out there and make some money and, you know, get validation or whatever it is. And that's not the way we tend to think. We tend to think that, you know, we have our own opinion about something and we tend to stick with it. And because we're independent, we don't have a major label or management or anything else to chewing our ear off because we're saying something inappropriate, you know. So we say what we think, pretty much.
Yeah, we do.
That's a great position to be in. Now, I'm on the tiniest of scales compared to you guys, but I don't work for anybody, and I can say what I want, and I have a big boatload of supporters who make darn sure that I'm independent and can say what I want.
Yes.
And that's the way I want to live.
Yes, yep. I totally agree. It's a personal choice, and some people love the machine, and they love being part of it, and they like being controlled, and we aren't those people.
No. There are some people who are just really good at that. You know, they're really good at turning up at the premiere and standing there and having their photo taken and all that. And we just, I don't know, it's just something in us that doesn't fit. The things that we enjoy more than anything else are, you know, recording, writing songs and doing shows. But sadly, the doing shows thing is now a thing of the past for us because we won't do a gig for our segregated audience. So, a lot of promoters are insisting on PCR tests or vaccinations for both the artist and the audience, and we won't play a part in that.
No.
Wow. Wow. Okay. Well, I was going to ask you, but you know what? I'm still going to ask you a question, and then we're going to get to that, because that really is the key subject right there. But I'm curious. Look, you guys were musicians for a while.
Yes.
Doing other work before you had the current band.
Yeah.
And then suddenly you have this smash hit, unprecedented in a lot of ways. And my guess would be that before that, you know, you did okay, but the life of a musician is much more precarious than people. People think everybody's a millionaire. And I'm sure that's not the case.
No, it's not.
But now suddenly you must have been. And I'm just curious, what's it like all of a sudden money's just raining down on you?
Yeah, it was. What was really the strangest thing was, is I'm Too Sexy, obviously, when it was a hit, we were lucky and it made us quite a bit of money. But then, as our careers started to crash out of control in about 97, 98, our money went up because it was being used in so many commercials and movies. So we had this bizarre situation where the press in the UK, I don't know if you know, but the tabloid press are pretty brutal and they do love something going wrong. So we were daily, it was, you know, Dead Said Fred and all this sort of stuff in the daily papers. So while our careers were sort of like on the decline, our income was the very opposite. Our income was going up because we had so many big synchronizations and the usage of the track was very expensive at the time. So it was very strange. You know, it was nice that we bought our houses and, you know, outright, and but we'd never been very extravagant. Yeah, we did.
We're pretty careful overall.
Yeah, we did the Porsche and Ferrari thing momentarily. And well, Richard crashed his Ferrari, so that was the end of that. So we did that. Yeah. And then we're pretty, not humble sounds like a really up your ass word, but we're sort of neighborhood blokes. I have a place in Barcelona with my wife. And when I'm in Barcelona, I live within about 4 or 5 blocks. And I'm the same in England. I've got my dry cleaners is local and my cafe and my pharmacy. And I just, you know, I bounce around him in about 4 or 5 blocks.
Yeah.
I'm a cheap date.
Yeah, you know. Exactly. Yeah. And also, I think with the money thing, you only really realize about the money that was coming in when it stops.
Yes, you do.
Yeah. Yeah.
Absolutely.
Do you know what I mean? When all the money was coming in, I remember having carpenters in my house with my partner at the time, and Stuart was sort of, you know, telling them what to do. And I mean, it was costing a fortune. I mean, it's ridiculous. When I look back, we paid £14,000 for a set of curtains. It's absolutely insane. But I only thought about how weird that was when I suddenly realized that now I can't afford £14 for a pair of curtains. not quite true, but I don't have to stick bin liners up on the wall or anything like that. But it is that thing that you, when you look back, you just think, my God, with that money, it was absurd, really. But we have been, the other thing about the money is we've always plowed stuff back into what we do. So we have our own studio and we spend a lot of money on recording new material. So we don't splash out at all. You know, we never have. Most of the money we've made tends to go back into recording.
Yeah.
Sometimes that pays off and sometimes it doesn't.
Yeah, we've had some exceptionally fabulous flops. but we've also been fortunate enough to have a few hits as well.
Yeah.
And for us, a hit record now is, I mean, being in the chart is nice. We've had 3 top fives. There's a new international chart called the Heritage Chart, and we've had 3 top fives in that in the last year. So that's been nice. But in terms of actual making money, we much rather would do a co-write with a well-known artist, or we get one of our songs on a commercial, video game, movie. That's far preferable.
Yeah,
it is.
Yeah, sure.
For us, music has become a little bit like stamp collecting. You know, you kind of hope that you're going to find a penny black at some point. But generally speaking, just plod on and do what you do. We just, the live thing has been a bit of a stressful thing because we were doing festivals. Yeah.
Every
weekend, pretty much. And we've lost a year and a half of work. We're lucky, as Fred says, to have written stuff. So we have what they call pipeline money from songs. But for artists that don't do that, who literally just earn whenever they're on stage, it's been an absolute nightmare. We were told of one quite famous singer, I can't remember who it was, who is now a dustman, and another one who is, what was the other one? Was he a taxi driver? I can't remember.
No, he's gone back to working for the council.
Oh, gone back to working for the council, that's right. Yeah, so, I mean, for some artists, it has been really, really tough, you know. The thing for us, worries us more than anything, I think, is the effect that it's having on the arts generally. You know, we can talk about the specific instances the artist having in terms of making ends meet. But the long-term consequences of this for the arts is absolutely horrendous. So we obviously, in Westminster, we have nothing but a bunch of Philistines who've got the boxes at the Royal Opera House and think they're music lovers, you know. So that's a worry. When we started, you know, every pub in London was a gig. It was a very, very exciting time in a way. Same with New York. When we went to New York in the 80s, you know, there were gigs absolutely everywhere. And now pubs are either closed down or they're not gigs at all. They're just posh kind of restaurants. You know, it's that end of it has gone completely. So for kids who are starting off now, unless they're working on a computer, if they're in a rock band of some kind, it's pretty tough, I think.
There was just an article published on a website, loudmouth.com, and it was called something like The Dangerous Rise of the COVID Conspiracy Rockstar. And it was an article about a grand total of two people, and not the two of you, I'm sorry to say, Eric Clapton and Van Morrison. So they wrote an entire article about the unbelievable danger of there being these two people. So two people with a dissenting voice is unbelievably dangerous, but getting the same mainstream BS rammed down our throats 24 hours a day is not alarming in the slightest.
No,
so right. I guess what I want to know is, I don't want any names, but when this thing was first shaping up and it hadn't been, you know, in, let's say, March of last year, and it hadn't been made clear to everybody yet exactly what the party line you were expected to take was, which is, of course, staying in my house and ruining society is the best way to go. Before that had really ossified, I bet in private conversation, there were at least some musicians who thought, well, we'll see where this goes, but at some point, you got to just live your life. So, I mean, what was your experience talking to other musicians before it became clear what their official opinion was supposed to be?
We didn't talk to many musicians, I'll be honest with you. I mean, a lot of them believed, the ones we did speak to, a lot of them believed the narrative completely.
Yeah.
They were more concerned about fitting in than actually voicing an opinion. Fortunately, the small circle of people we work with in the studio, they're all on board and they think it's a load of BS and won't sort of...
Won't
entertain it, yeah. But what the wider reach in terms of people we chat with, it's been pretty depressing, actually. I've seen people sending pictures in of they're in sessions and everyone's got a mask on. I'm just thinking, what the fuck are you people doing?
Yeah, I mean, the first thing I'd like to say is something, just very quickly say something about Eric Clapton. Eric Clapton is not a conspiracy theorist. The people who attack Eric Clapton are completely misunderstanding his position.
I'm sure.
In my opinion. All he did was he went on, was interviewed on Oracle Films about the consequences for him personally of the vaccination. He merely reiterated his story. That's all he did. The people who attack him for merely reiterating his story and repeating his story, I think are indefensible. They are so unkind. Words fail me. He went through, it must have been very frightening for him because I think he lost the use of his hands for some time. It must have been very frightening for him. And he just told his story. That's all he did. The weird thing, I think, now is that the idea that conspiracy theories only happen on one side. So that the idea that if you're the head of Google and the head of Facebook and the head of God knows what else, that these people don't conspire together, that there's no conspiracy going on within government, that there's no conspiracy going on between the pharmaceutical companies and government and the media, really? The conspiracy theories are all over the place. And it beggars belief that this idea that conspiracy theories are the preserve of the, you know, tin foil hat brigade on one side only, and that everybody else is driven by pure logic and science. It's absolute nonsense. Everybody conspires one way or the other. Our position has been and is always that I trust my family and me more than anybody else. I don't know Boris Johnson. Why would I trust him? I don't know Hancock. I don't know Sadiq Javid. I don't know these people. Why would I trust them? I don't trust the voices on either side implicitly. I make my mind up as I go along. And I mean, recently we had this ridiculous Paul McCartney getting his jab. And my problem with him and people like him is, if you're going to have the jab, fine. It's a personal decision that you've taken. Do it. The minute you turn the camera on it and post it, it's propaganda. That's what you're doing. So understand the difference. Make a personal decision. Absolutely fine. I have no problem with that. But point the camera at it, just about when the Queen supposedly got the jab, which I don't believe in for a minute, by turning the camera on it and filming it, she became part of the government narrative. And as a consequence, she should be ashamed.
Well, of course, because, you know, it's one thing to take an Eric Clapton position and be unpopular. Mm. But to do this in the full knowledge that you're going to get wild cheers from huge numbers of people, what possible benefit is there? Because to me, I want a courageous person. I want somebody who bucks the trend. I know you're going to get the jab. Yeah. You know, I already know that there's nothing impressive to me about this. Why would it be?
Yeah, exactly. The weird thing for me throughout this whole business is that what we're looking at here is, and everybody knows this, is this vaccine is on trial and will be on trial until 2023. It's experimental. It's only for use under emergency legislation. So why on earth are we not hearing a more balanced narrative, both from the government and from the scientists and from the press? That's what I don't understand. There seems to be a complete lockdown, if you like, of dissenting voices. And I heard an Australian show today where a woman was, I think she was a DJ or a guest, and she was saying basically that she's very hesitant about having the vaccine and she, you know, she's not that enthusiastic about it. And every time she sort of uttered an opinion on this, they bleeped her out. I mean, it's extraordinary.
Yeah, it's insane. And in the United States, it's even crazier because the development of the Pfizer vaccine took place here. And I can find you, and I know you know this already, so many people on Twitter who in September of last year were saying, I'm not going to get any experimental Trump vaccine pumped into me.
Yeah.
6 months later, exactly the same people saying, got my vaccine appointment. Now, okay, you could change your mind. I mean, there's nothing wrong with people changing their minds.
Yeah.
But it's just weird that they happen to have the precisely exquisitely expected opinions at the precisely exquisitely expected moments.
Yes.
These are weird people. That's weird. And it is legitimate to wonder, I don't know what the long-term consequences of this thing are, exactly. Or I've already had the virus and I do have this crazy superstitious belief in natural immunity. So why is this crazy pressure being put on me? And then your point about so-called conspiracy theories going both ways.
Yeah.
One of the things Eric Clapton mentioned in a recent interview was something he read and signed called the Great Barrington Declaration.
Yes, that's right. Yeah.
Which involves one of your professors from Oxford and then two American professors basically saying that lockdown is absolutely catastrophic public health policy and we should simply keep vulnerable people safe.
Yeah.
And that thing, which was signed by a few scientists who had no desire to be in the public eye over this and take the slings and arrows, none whatsoever. They were accused of getting big money from this or that foundation. There's no money involved. They wrote, what, a 1,000-word statement. There's no money in that.
No.
But the accusation was that was why they were in it.
Yes, that's right. Yeah. In fact, I mean, I would think, certainly for someone like Sunetra Gupta, you know, that's the last thing she wanted to do was be in the crosshairs. She just, she made the mistake of voicing her opinion.
Like we did.
Obviously her opinion is a lot more
credible.
But nevertheless, it's now, if you question the narrative on any level, irrespective, you know, whether it's masks or vaccinations or anything at all, you are a heretic and you are anti-everything.
It's the great shame for me is two things, really. One is the lack of support that the artists have given the notion of freedom of conscience. You know, you can be pro-vax, you can be anti-vax, I don't really mind, but you should be in favor of freedom of conscience, you know, bodily integrity and all that stuff. I'm amazed at the lack of, I mean, Springsteen was a really good example, along with the Foo Fighters. It's really tragic when people involved in the arts get into the idea that it's appropriate for the arts to promote segregation. It is not. The whole point about music and the arts is to bring people together. And you don't have to agree with your neighbor. You don't have to be on the same page in all things, but you should absolutely defend your neighbor's right to make their own decision and not attack them for it. But sadly, people like Springsteen, Foo Fighters, many others have weighed in on the narrative that means that anybody that disagrees with that position is some kind of idiot. And it's very depressing. And we've had no guidance from the government. We've had no real inspirational kind of, messaging from the government about thinking for yourself, freedom of conscience, liberty, freedom, all that stuff. You know, we've had nothing from Johnson, nothing from any of them. They are such a bunch of absolute idiots. The sooner we clear out the Westminster and start again, the better.
It was a Trump saying, but we need to drain the swamp.
We do, absolutely.
Yeah, we do.
Yeah, no doubt about it. Folks, let's take a minute to thank our sponsor, Stamps.com. If there's one thing that in our divided society holds us together. It's that nobody wants to go stand in line at the post office. Well, with Stamps.com, you can skip trips to the post office and save on postage. It really is a great service. Stamps.com makes it easy for small businesses to mail and ship without needing to take that trip to the post office. You can print official U.S. postage and shipping labels 24/7 without having to leave your desk or buy any fancy equipment. All you need is your computer and a standard printer. And once your mail is ready, you just schedule a pickup or drop it off. It's that simple. Stamps.com saves nearly a million small business owners like you time and money, plus deals you can't get anywhere else, like up to 40% off USPS and up to 66% off UPS shipping rates. So stop wasting time going to the post office and go to Stamps.com instead. There's no risk. And with my promo code Woods, you get a special offer that includes a 4-week trial, plus free postage and a digital scale. No long-term commitments or contracts. Just go to Stamps.com. Click on the microphone at the top of the homepage and type in Woods. That's Stamps.com, promo code Woods. Stamps.com, never go to the post office again. There is a huge, almost unimaginable void out there in terms of there being millions, tens of millions, maybe hundreds of millions of people who don't like where things are going.
Yeah, that's true.
And there's almost no one speaking for them. We have the most unanimous public health messaging ever from the stupidest ruling class in the history of the world. And we don't have that one. Okay, in the United States, we have U.S. Senator Rand Paul, but he doesn't have the temperament to be a leader of hundreds of millions. We need that handful of people, the Eric Claptons who want to be world leaders, have the opportunity to rally tens of millions of people in the streets if they want to, anytime they want to, because people are just waiting to be told, how do we stop this? Where are those people? Like, for example, there's a very well-known Canadian intellectual who's gotten to be known all around the world. That's Jordan Peterson.
Right now,
he's talking about sex designations on birth certificates. And that's a legitimate issue you can talk about. But that issue is still going to be there 2 weeks from now.
Yeah, exactly.
Somebody like a Jordan Peterson should be standing up and saying, I'm a public intellectual with a following, and I say we're not complying with this.
Yeah.
It would be absolute pandemonium if he did that. Why won't they do it?
I don't know. I mean, that's what we were saying earlier. You know, the lack of leadership on this. We've been to several marches in London, the last one, which was particularly chaotic, we thought. But one of the big problems has been a focal point. It's a real problem to try and boil this down to a simple message, because it's, in a way, it's such a huge issue. This is an attack on the very nature of what it is to be human, I think. And it's such a big question. I think a lot of people almost shy away from thinking about it because it just seems too big to consider. You know, if you're going to tell a lie, tell a really big one. If you're going to rob a bank, rob a really big one. You know, it's that. But I agree with you, Thomas. I completely agree with you. I think, you know, it needs focus and it needs passion. People need to understand that they have it in their gift to make the difference. I think so many people are beaten down.
Yeah, discouraged.
And discouraged and dispirited. Yeah, we did. When we went to the march last, it was about 2 or 3 weeks ago in Trafalgar Square, we were just milling around and talking to people. And there's a lady who came up to us. She was probably mid-50s, I would think. And we said hello and we greeted each other and everything else. And as she turned away, she was crying. I should never forget that. She was crying because to some people, this is truly awful. This is not, it's really, really sad. And for many people who are living on their own, if they don't have any, you know, much money, you know, they don't have a big house with a garden where they can sit outside and drink, you know, champagne and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
It's a war on the poor as much as anything else.
It is.
Absolutely.
And we regret not giving her a hug because she turned away. We could both see she was crying. And it was one of those moments, you know, by the time you'd thought about it, it was gone. But it really, I shall never forget that. And I think politicians who don't truly understand the damage that they are doing to people's spirit and to the culture of a country. And we go back to the arts again. It's killing the arts in this country. If not, the art, you know, you could argue that musically speaking, at least it's already dead.
I was just going to mention that about people's spirits because I've stayed in Trafalgar Square a couple of times. I absolutely love London. I really genuinely love it.
Yes.
And I'd been looking forward to getting back there. And I'm just thinking, when someday that does happen, what are the people I'm going to encounter going to be like? These, I feel like a lot of them are going to be shells of their former selves.
Well, that's exactly right. We had to go to Gibraltar over the weekend for some business meetings, and we're trying to set up a festival which is unrestricted. So vaccinated, unvaccinated, tested, not tested, basically like festivals used to be. And we've had a very good response. And so we're in discussions with various investors and sponsors. Anyway, the meetings happened in Gibraltar. And Gibraltar was a breath of fresh air. I know it's a tiny little place, 30,000 people, but it was upbeat. People were incredibly sort of passionate about their lives, and they would immediately hug you when you met them. There was no stand.
No elbow bumping.
There's no elbow bumping. There's no stand. No one asked you to see your medical status. And when we got back to Heathrow, we were immediately back into the belly of the beast. And it was quite a significant sort of comparison. It certainly reminded us how the UK has become a bit of a fun-free zone, unless you want to comply with everything you're told to comply with.
And also, I think, going back to what you were saying to us about London, if you want to have a city or a culture that is artistically vibrant and full of risk-taking and entrepreneurial and exciting and fresh, you've got to get politicians out of the way. That is it. You cannot have a heavily controlled and sort of tracked and traced, monitored city or culture if you want to have vibrant arts.
Well, yeah, but also not to mention, you can't have the West End opening and closing and opening and closing. You can't prepare, you can't plan, can't invest.
Exactly. Well, we were talking to our promoter who's Dutch, and he is our agent, and he's tearing his hair out because that's exactly what's happened. You know, he'll go in, talk to the government on the Monday, and they'll say, no, it's all fine. You know, you can plan gigs for, you know, August. And then by Friday, they've closed everything down again. He said,
It is insane.
It is insane.
What's it been like there in the UK, though, since the so-called Freedom Day? Are people still crazy or what?
No.
Can I just say, how Orwellian is the notion of Freedom Day?
I know. I'm sorry. Well, I even had to say it.
Yeah, it's like something out of North Korea, isn't it? What was interesting, that's the very day Boris Johnson took to discuss even more restrictions.
Yes.
And that's just to mess with your head, you know. So Freedom Day was whatever it was, 19th of July, was it? Something like that. And that was the day that he did a press conference to then tell people about who's going to have to get vaxxed and who won't be allowed into certain areas if you're unvaccinated, more restrictions on travel, more restrictions on, you know, you can't work unless you get a jab. So it was real mind games. He chose that day to issue more restrictions. Yeah. I mean, sadly, a lot of people don't seem to get it. They still think this is about a virus. Yeah, totally confused.
Michael Gove, who should know better, described people who weren't going to get vaccinated as selfish. He didn't, what he should say, as a politician of the right, he should say that people have the right to make up their own mind, and we encourage people to do that. The best that we can do is we can give you all the facts as we see them. We can give you all the information we have, and then it's up to you to make your own mind up. That's not what they're doing. What they are doing is they are demonizing people who disagree with them. And that's it. They are a completely indefensible bunch. And that applies to Biden. It applies to all politicians. I mean, Duterte in the Philippines. I mean, these people are insane. Same with Ardern in New Zealand. Same with Morrison in Australia. These people are completely bonkers. They are absolutely, honestly, they are.
They
used to think that democracy was some kind of protection against tyranny. One thing we have learned is that it's not. You know, tyranny can happen. Democratically elected government can be as tyrannical and as abusive of civil rights as any other.
But this government, because of we're in a constant state of emergency, is no longer a democracy.
No, it's not.
That's gone.
Well, the thing is, the so-called democratic government is the dominant voice in opinion molding in the country.
Yes.
Everybody jumps on board. It's crazy, fear-mongering propaganda.
Yes.
Now, I'm lucky because I live in Florida, and I happen to live here at random. We moved here 5 years ago. At no time did it occur to me I'll need to be here for the sake of living a normal human life. That thought never – I just figured I was choosing a random state in the U.S. And what we have to acknowledge here, despite any of his other flaws, is that our governor, he will turn out to be a figure of literally world historic importance.
DeSantis is amazing.
He stood up to everyone. And not only has he stood up to them, he's mocked and laughed at them. just the other day, he was criticizing people who consider it a moral failing if you get COVID because you weren't following the rule. Look, we all know people who follow all the governor of Nevada had just got done yelling at the people of Nevada for not following the rules. The next week, he got the virus and said, gee, I followed all the rules. Duh. You know, so anyway, but in Florida, just a day or two ago, DeSantis said, look, we all know people who have lived like hermits for 18 months and wore 6 masks and still got it.
Yeah.
So I mean, laughing at them in that way, they need to be ridiculed. One thing I'll say, I probably shouldn't say the name because I didn't get his permission, but let's just say I had lunch with an extremely elite medical school professor.
Right.
Of very, very mild-mannered, but tough as nails on this stuff. Right. And he said to me, all the things you've done on this virus matter, the most important thing you have done is to ridicule Dr. Fauci.
Yeah.
Not just criticize him. These people need to be laughed at. Yeah. That is extremely important.
Yeah, I agree. Well, it's the old saying is, in the face of laughter, nothing can stand.
Yeah.
And, you know, I don't know what it's like in Florida, but I can tell you one thing in the UK. We are sleepwalking. I think a lot of people do not understand what they are walking into. And when you talk about the digitization of, say, passports and vaccine passports and passes of various kinds, you know, the response you get is, well, if you want to go to India, you've got to have a malaria jab. They don't understand the difference. And once all this interconnectivity is established between your bank, your doctor, your employer, and everything else, your life will be completely in the hands of people that you can't even see and you've never heard of.
Absolutely.
So independence of thinking. I truly believe if you want to survive this, you've got to be self-employed. You've got to find a little local shop where you can get all your stuff and do the rest online. Mm. Because I think the more you interact with the state and the more you interact with people who control or attempt to control your life, the more trouble you're going to have.
What's DeSantis' ratings like in Florida? Is he just sweeping the board?
He's doing fairly well. The thing is, there are a lot of Floridians who are transplanted Northerners who, you know, their mentality is they want the government to run their lives. They just like the no income tax now that they're retired.
I've got you. Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
But on the other hand, he is attracting a huge number of people down here. There are a lot of people who are here very deliberately because they understand what he's all about. Yeah. I think he's going to raise an absolute boatload of money for his reelection. So right. I think there was some fluke headline today saying he's actually neck and neck with some Democrat. I don't believe that for a second. When push comes to shove and you got to raise money against Ron DeSantis, good luck. No, he's actually been very, very popular, partly because he just doesn't care.
Yes.
He's not trying to split the difference with anybody. Yes. And at the same time, it's interesting that there are some Democrats who respect him because he has been fair-minded. He does listen to them. If they needed something during this crisis, he gave it to them.
Yeah.
So he has nevertheless been politically savvy enough to build up good relationships.
Right.
Okay,
yeah.
Right.
Yeah, you know, I think in life generally, most things are, if you're a politician, I think if you have a pretty sort of settled set of beliefs, most situations are fairly easy to deal with. It's when you have people like Johnson in charge who just go in any direction seemingly that suits them at that particular time. And what DeSantis has, it seems to me, he has a very, very fixed set of beliefs that he has, and he sticks by it. You know, you can slag off Margaret Thatcher, for instance. A lot of people do. But you knew what she was. You knew what she, where she stood. And actually, bizarrely, although I couldn't stand him at the time, Jeremy Corbyn was interesting looking back because he although he'd sort of shilly-shallied around the EU issue, broadly speaking, he maintained his position. And, you know, that's what people are looking for in politicians. They're looking for politicians of commitment and belief and passion. They're not looking for politicians who are obsessed with, you know, polls and focus groups.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, listen, I want to be respectful of your time. I gave you an amount of time that we would spend, so I don't want to go too much over that. But I guess I just have one last little question,
though
it could be a big one, but you can make it as brief as you like. Would you say that this experience we've endured has confirmed you in your existing political outlook, or has it maybe changed it somewhat?
It's changed me completely.
Changed Richard and confirmed mine.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yes.
So you've been trying to convince Richard of things for years, and it took Boris Johnson to accomplish the job.
Well, I kind of went down the rabbit hole quite a few years, about over 20 years ago. And I had a bit of a baptism of fire when I was listening to people like Alex Jones and then James Corbett. And I was interested in the alternative voice, really. I didn't think one thing or the other. I just wanted to hear other people speaking outside the mainstream media.
How about that? Yeah.
Yeah. And then, you know, I just thought that was interesting. And then Rich and I disagreed about quite a lot of things over the years. And then when this happened 18 months ago, and we started seeing things develop that had been mentioned in reports like the lockstep and, you know, the World Economic Forum and things like that, he sort of shifted a little bit over to where I am. So we agree on most things to do with this. I think I'm probably a little bit more conspiratorial than Richard, but not that much. I
have definitely moved to the left politically.
Yeah, we're both further to the left politically. I suppose we are really, yeah.
I just don't try. My thing in the past was I don't trust the state. So therefore, I'm in favor of individualism and I'm in favor of...
It's just that in the US, if you were to say, I've just moved to the left, it would mean I want to run the society and tell everybody how to live the virus.
Yes, yes.
So it's very different there and here, I guess.
It is. Yes, it is.
I think Churchill once said that nothing disappoints you when, in terms of democracy, nothing more undermines your belief in democracy than when you actually meet a voter.
Yep.
And I think, you know, I understand it. But what I have learned through all this is you cannot trust the state to defend your fundamental liberties and rights. You cannot. You have to stand up and declare them for yourself. That's it.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know?
Yep. What other lesson is there?
Yeah.
How can people follow you these days?
We're
on a bike.
yeah, exactly. We're on Twitter, it's @TheFreds.
Yeah.
The website is rightsaidfred.com. Facebook is Right Said Fred, and Instagram is Right Said Fred Official. Yeah.
Yeah.
Are you fighting with fans on social media or ignoring them?
We don't. No, we've made more friends than lost friends, I think, throughout.
Good.
We have. Yeah, that's definitely true. Yeah.
Well, there aren't that many games in town, I'm sorry to tell you, in terms of musicians who are telling the truth.
No, I agree. Yeah. I mean, we do get a lot of people coming up to us who I think probably pretend to their friends and to people in their employer, whatever, that they are on board with this sort of government thing. And then they come up to us rather sheepishly and say, you know, they shake your hand and say, well done for what you're saying. I completely get it. There's a guy on my Twitter today. He went up in Scotland. He was up in Scotland, went into his butchers. And the butcher said, you know, well done for what you're doing. I'm really, really, you know, behind you and everything else. You know, that kind of sentiment is really, really important. We went took a cab ride the other week in London, and, you know, the fare was about 18 quid. And the driver said, you know, no charge, because I completely agree with what you're doing. So it's...
There's some nice moments.
There are some really, really good moments. And people need support. People who are lonely, people who are skint, people who are finding this whole thing incredibly distressing, they need to feel supported. And they're not getting that support from government at all. It's terrible.
Yes, no, agree. And of course, from friends and family, I mean, what's been done to... people have just had relationships torn up, and you can't even begin to fathom, because we can see the huge consequences, like in the developing world, you know, obviously they're poor to a degree we can't imagine, and then supply lines break down. So we have huge, huge high-profile disasters, but then just that little micro-disaster, the divorce in the house next to you, stuff like that. Where do we even begin chronicling it all?
Exactly. Yeah, I know. There's an awful lot of invisible pain out there. There really is. And sadly, for some reason which I can't quite understand, the people that we elect to represent us just don't seem to care. They just don't, you know?
And I think it's a big pill for a lot of people to swallow.
It is, yeah.
To actually come to terms with the fact that people maybe they've believed in, voted for, even bought the merch or the T-shirts, actually just don't give a crap. I think that's a really big hurdle.
Yeah, it is. It is. We need to wake up. People that we elect... It's like, you know, Israel is a really good example. There's a whole bunch of them. Netanyahu is actually talking about chipping children so that when they're in school, if they get too close to each other, there's an alarm will go off. I mean, it's just, these people are insane. They actually need to, you know, we need to medicate them and put them in a sanatorium.
Yeah. If anybody needs something forcibly given to them, it's these people.
It is. That's exactly right.
Exactly right. Absolutely.
Yeah.
All right. Listen, gentlemen, I can't tell you how much I appreciate your time and what you're out there doing. And I hope people will follow you. I'll put all the stuff you mentioned up at tomwoods.com/1945. Thank you so much.
Yeah. And thank you, Tom. Thanks for the stuff you're doing. Yeah. I really appreciate it. Yeah,
absolutely. Cheers, mate. Thank you. Enjoyed it.
Bye-bye.
All right, everybody, we are cooking with gas now. We are continuing on with the Tom Woods Show with all Woods here as the host. Tomorrow, it's going to be Dan McCarthy, our old friend. We're going to be talking about what's been going on with January 6th and the commission and all that sort of material. And of course, and I want to remind you that we're moving full steam ahead with the Tom Woods Show 2000th episode event. Everything is on schedule and fine for that. We're going to have an absolute blast at that event, and I really, really hope you can attend, especially at a time like right now when the trend is toward closing up societies. Well, we're opening this one up, baby, because we're having a big, big, wide-open event with as many people as we can fit down at the Rose and Shingle Creek, October 16th, 2021, here in Orlando, Florida. It is going to be a tremendous time with some of your favorite guests from the Tom Woods Show, and a lot of surprises and just a ton of fun all night, and it doesn't cost you a thing. I'm paying for the whole event as a thank you to my listeners for being such good people and sticking it out and sticking it to the man. And so I really, really hope you can join me for that. Get all the details you need at tomwoods2000.com. We've added very recently some more rooms to our room block. So if you've decided that you'd actually like to stay at the resort where we're having the event, there should now be more rooms available for those of you who would like to do that. You don't have to do that, but for convenience sake, some people are in fact doing that. So the details can be found at tomwoods2000.com, and I'll see you tomorrow.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit tomwoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.
Like the sound of the Tom Woods Show? My audio production is provided by Podsworth Media. Check them out at podsworth.com.